the focus on voting is because it is the underpinning of all of our other rights. I mean, if you cannot cast a ballot in an election, how else can you express yourself? It is the starting place of all these other rights, which is why I think that the denial of the right to vote is so insidious, so deeply troubling, that there are whole communities of people, whether it's people with a criminal conviction or it's people who are not able to get a voter ID, who are just blocked from that. I am hard-pressed to think of anything worse, frankly.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Hannah Fried is the National Campaign Director of All Voting is Local, located at the Leadership Conference Education Fund. The All Voting is Local campaign fights to protect and expand the right to vote for every American by focusing on the administrative side of elections, striving to help identify and remedy barriers to the ballot box. Hannah is a lawyer who's worked on voter protection for national campaigns and organizations. For me, All Voting is Local is an interesting example of political entrepreneurship, having stemmed from Hannah's work founding an independent enterprise called Access Democracy, which then found an excellent home in an existing institution. When you talk to Hannah, it is clear that she has a ton of knowledge and a real passion for protecting the right to vote for all citizens of the United States. We had a very good conversation, well worth your listen. So first, our sponsor, and then my interview with Hannah Fried and All Voting is Local.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Hannah.
Hey.
How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'd be happy to. My name is Hannah Fried. I'm the campaign director for All Voting is Local, which is a collaborative campaign here at the Leadership Conference Education Fund, and has as our national partners the Campaign Legal Center, American Constitution Society, the ACLU, and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights.
The big guns,
sure.
in the space. Well, what's the mission of All Voting is Local?
Yeah, so we have as our mission stopping voter suppression before it starts. We work on the ground in states across the country that have a history of voter suppression and ongoing voter suppression problems. And we don't want to wait to tackle those until they blow up. We don't want to wait till the lines are 4 hours long at the polls. We want to address these problems in advance. That's what we focus on.
I don't understand. Who would be opposed to people voting?
No one should be. It is quintessentially American. I'm hard-pressed to think of something more fundamentally American and a value that we should share. Voting is that. It is that core value.
And so the other side must just be interested in making sure that the right people vote, right?
I think that every person should agree that eligible Americans should make their voices heard so that that playing field is even, so that everyone is equally able to make their voices heard, cast their ballot for the candidate of their choice, and move this country in the direction that we collectively, all of us equally, want to go in.
What's actually happening then that merits a campaign to stop it?
Yeah. Well, in 2016, there were a million people more who wanted to vote but couldn't, who went to their polling place and saw a long line or got asked for a voter ID that they didn't have with them or asked for an absentee ballot that never came in the mail. These are people who are motivated to turn out, who are being stopped by the way that we run our elections. Every eligible person in this country should be able to vote free from discrimination, intimidation, or suppression.
Well, you come out of a long background on the Democratic side of politics, as I do. And might it not just be the case that you want more Democratic voters to vote?
Our focus here is totally nonpartisan. What we focus on are communities that have for years, for decades, for centuries, not been able to make their voices heard. That's the mission of All Voting is Local, and that's what we do every day here.
So tell me a little about this. What's the founding story for All Voting is Local?
Yeah. The group of organizations that I mentioned came together in recognition of a real problem, particularly in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Shelby County case. And in that case, five justices of the U.S. Supreme Court gutted a core provision of the Voting Rights Act that had for decades ensured that changes to the way that voting happens, new voting rules, would be pre-cleared, is what it was called, would be checked first by the federal government before being put into place in a selection of states that had a long history of discrimination. A lot of those were in the South, but not only. Alaska was a state that was covered as well, for example.
A huge and powerful part of the law.
Yes, arguably the most critical. And its loss has been significant. It's meant that decisions are being made in elections now without that check. There's no transparency about sort of how those decisions are made, and there's no analysis of the impact. We don't know, and the government that makes the decision, the election officials that make the decision, aren't forced to inquire, really investigate, is our decision going to have an impact on Black and brown voters? Is it going to make it harder for them to vote? Those questions don't have to get asked anymore.
Well, my sense was that right after that decision, there was actually almost a movement to take advantage of this change and to change rules in various clever ways to bring down the voting of certain populations.
Yeah. So one thing we've seen, the Leadership Conference Education Fund put out a report earlier this fall about poll closures in the wake of the Shelby County decision. And what that report found was that there have been almost 1,700 polling place closures since Shelby, and 75% of those between 2014 and 2018. This is in formerly covered under Section 5 cities and counties and states. And one thing to think about is that 2018 had higher turnout than a lot of recent elections. And so the idea that you are having fewer places for people to vote, particularly in states that have a long history of discrimination, that's very troubling.
What was the rationale for the Supreme Court to change something which had been well established and had been an important tool of the federal government for a long time?
In the court's opinion, one thing that they talked about was that the preclearance process needed to respond to modern conditions. I think a lot of people rightly said, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And there is ample record of discrimination in voting in Section 5 states and frankly beyond, right? That is all across the country. We see these poll closures. We see voter ID laws that make it harder for African-American voters in Wisconsin to vote. We see more voters in Pennsylvania casting provisional ballots in counties that have more African-American voters. We see a lack of access to early vote in Florida, right? So all across the country, we see these problems impacting voters of color, just as they have for decades.
What's your sense of the motivations behind these rule changes?
Yeah, I mean, look, people say all kinds of things about why they want these rules to change, but at the end of the day,
sometimes they're overheard being very clear about it, right?
Certainly, that does happen. But I think that whatever the motivation, and sometimes there's evidence that there's something intentional going on, but just as often there's, you know, the motive I sort of set to the side, because at the end of the day, what we see are voters who are trying to vote who cannot. And that's a real problem in this country that we have to face head on.
It's pretty appalling that every election that there's coverage of giant lines. And it seems like we should be able to manage a process like that a little bit better, one that is so integral to a democracy.
It does. And that is a lot of what led us to stand up All Voting is Local, that we recognized that there was a space for work that was exclusively focused, laser focused on those kinds of problems. Litigation is a huge piece of the fight for voting rights, and there are so many groups that are doing excellent work in that space. And legislative work is really important. You got to make sure that the laws, federal and state, are strong and protective of the right to vote. That like third leg of the stool is this work, the focus on the decisions that election officials make every day, year round, about how to run their elections. We are one of the groups that is laser focused on that kind of decision making.
I had talked to a friend of yours, Alexis, back some time ago about something called Access Democracy, which seemed to have a similar mission. How did it transform from what was going on 2 years ago to something housed within some big institutions? What was the path there?
Yeah.
Explain that.
Yeah, so Alexis and I had worked together on voter protection campaigns for a number of years. And what we saw was what I've been sharing, the problems that voters face when they go to cast a ballot and those barriers. And so we started this project, Access Democracy, which subsequently got incubated here at the Leadership Conference Education Fund, which was really exciting for us. I mean, we'd been sitting at my kitchen table for about a year, hustling pretty hard. And it then got rolled into the broader mission of All Voting is Local, which is this broader collaboration that I've described involving a lot of national organizations and a lot of state partners as well. And I think being situated in the legacy of the civil rights community, I mean, the Leadership Conference has been around since 1950, to have this be a recognized part of important civil rights work is a great honor. And I think it is. I think it is an important piece of the fight for voting rights, and I'm so glad we're able to do that.
Was the Leadership Conference already working in this space at all?
Oh, yeah. The Leadership Conference was intimately involved in the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Voting rights work has long been a part of this organization's mission. And because it also serves as the convening of 200 plus other civil rights groups, it is really a natural home for this work and a focus, of course, of all of our 200 partners.
So did you come to them? Did they come to you? How did this marriage get made?
Well, that's a great question. I guess Alexis knew some folks here and they'd heard about what we were trying to do and thought it might fit into this broader work around voting.
Did they have to find new funding for that, or did they fund it out of things that they were already doing? I'm often interested in the entrepreneurship involved in making something like this happen. And you were one of many groups that, you know, a lot of them started in the wake of the Trump election, but some not, that reach different levels of scale. But this is one interesting model of like getting something going and then bringing it into an existing institution to give it longer legs or more power. Or
I think you've really hit on something, which is that especially after Shelby, I think that advocates and funders too, I think the whole community of people who care about these issues have been looking for new ways to fight this fight. And that is what All Voting is Local helps to do. It directs that energy towards this important piece, which is the decisions that election officials make. And, you know, that's certainly something, I mean, I would not want to pretend that we were the first folks ever to think of that. I mean, that would not be fair at all. But I think that it is a place that has not gotten enough attention and not enough resourcing, particularly when you see how, you know, the loss of Shelby has impacted this and these poll closures and voter ID and purges, right? You can see that there's such a need for focusing on that piece of this work.
Well, it's painful to see retrogression, right? It's painful to see to have to fight fights that were already won. And that's happening across a lot of spaces right now. But to follow up on that previous question, do you have to continue to fundraise for this? Where are resources coming to, and sort of what scale are you at this point?
Yeah, so we, because of one of the things that we're doing now is actually expanding into additional states. So we are in Arizona, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And we are now, I'm very happy to share, able to staff in those states and add staff in Georgia, Nevada, and Michigan. Michigan. And so, you know, to your question, look, I mean, there are more problems out there than we could ever hope to fully solve. And so if folks want to support our work, we are always looking for innovative ways to do this. And it is because of that that we are able now to do some more work in some additional states.
Well, what does staff in a state mean? What do staff do?
Yeah. So we have state directors in all of our states. Part of our model is having that on-the-ground relationship. Our state directors are from their states, have lived there for, some of them for their whole lives. Many of our team come from the civil rights and voting rights world. They know that landscape. And because these problems are happening at such a local level, it's so important to be able to build a relationship with those local folks, whether it's advocates or election officials. I mean, in Wisconsin, for example, you have city election officials, right? You can hardly get more local than that. So you got to have that FaceTime. You got to sit down. You got to get that cup of coffee.
And a cup of coffee is going to make a difference in decisions?
It can. It can.
How does that work?
I am always surprised by how we underestimate the power of just making that ask.
Is there implied threat there too? Like, if you don't do this, you know, we're watching. We're going to make public what you might be up to, or you may not be aware of the consequences. How do you approach that kind of thing through
local? We always start from a place of collaboration, because I believe that, you know, most election officials want to do their job and do it well. That's always got to be your starting place. And sometimes it's saying, hey, have you thought about doing it this way? Or, hey, did you know that because you have only these hours for voting, that it's making it a lot harder for this community to cast a ballot? Sometimes it's just sharing that information and giving that sort of background so that people can make decisions that are better, frankly, that are more protective of the right to vote. That said, we don't shy away from shining a spotlight when an election official is not making that kind of decision that expands access to the ballot. Right now in Ohio, we've been calling out the voter purge there, which has been found, including by the admission of the Secretary of State, to be replete with problems. People are on that list who should not be on that list. The president of the League of Women Voters of Ohio shared her own story of getting into the pipeline to be purged. Election officials should be called out when they are not making it easier for people who should be voting to cast a ballot.
In that particular case in Ohio, how many people were purged?
Hundreds of thousands of Ohioans are going to be purged just this year, just under 500,000.
And that's typically, in certain ways, kind of a database problem, right? People die, people move, you want to have a clean database, theoretically. What do you read happening in that particular case?
I think that election officials should be as committed to making sure that they're getting people onto the rolls as they are to removing people. You know, in Georgia is another really good example of what we've seen around this. I mean, now governor, then Secretary of State Kemp purged almost a million and a half people after 2010. And there were 50,000 people last year who were in this sort of limbo status because of a minor issue, sort of discrepancy on their voter registration.
Their name is spelled differently, so they can't suddenly vote.
Yeah, missing hyphen, for example, right? I mean, that's a reason to put you into this limbo status, right? To me, what that says is I am more interested in pushing people off the rolls than I am in getting them on and staying on, eligible people. And by the way, this, like every problem we see in voting, falls disproportionately on voters of color, low-income voters, and young people.
Why?
So some of that is just the reality of people's lives. If you move, you're a student, you move, or your housing situation is insecure, right? You are moving, your address is changing, that impacts your voter registration. The state sends you a notice to say, hey, are you still registered here? But you've moved. Doesn't mean you're ineligible. Doesn't mean you're even not eligible to vote at that same precinct. But they can't reach you, and you didn't vote for a couple of elections, so you're done. I mean, look, I was myself a purge voter in 2008. You know, in some ways, I think it's sort of surprising, right? Because I work in this space, in the voting rights space, but I also fit the profile pretty well. I was young, I was in my mid-20s, and I was a student. And I got dinged from the rolls, and that resulted in me not voting in 2008.
I've been around the world of voting lists and election returns and things like that for most of my career. Whenever I have this conversation with somebody, I'm always wondering, why do we even need to register to vote? That just seems like an unnecessary piece of bureaucracy between a person and a vote. Do you understand that?
Well, you know, in North Dakota, you don't actually have to register in advance. And a lot of states are moving increasingly towards various voter registration modernizations, whether it's automatic voter registration, so you go to the DMV and you get added or your registration gets updated, or same-day registration, you can register and vote when you go to the polls to cast a ballot.
That seems quite reasonable.
It is, and it works really well. Yeah. And all of these are shown to increase registration and participation. So it is certainly the direction that we should be moving in. Absolutely.
As a country, are we going in the right direction or the wrong direction?
Long game, we're moving probably in the right direction on this issue of voting, right? But two steps forward, one step back, at least, right?
I mean, steps back, one step forward.
That, you know, maybe, right? I mean,
my sense is that we're going backwards of late, depending on the place.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are progressive reforms, and I don't want to be too much of a pessimist, right? I mean, automatic voter registration and other voter registration modernization, the expansion of vote by mail to more and more of a community, right? I mean, those are good things. But, you know, every day we come in here and work towards improving those problems that are entrenched. Some of these problems are not getting better because we are not tackling them in the way we need to.
How long ago did All Voting is Local start?
So we launched in the spring of 2018.
Mm-hmm. During that time, what are the couple things you're most proud of having accomplished?
One of the things I think is of great value, this work, is that we bring this really specific focus on election official decisions, and that is becoming more and more a recognized part of the fight for voting rights. When people talk about voting rights, they don't just think back in history and talk about poll taxes, right? We see our work as part of that kind of legacy, right? Combating that. But people talk about long lines. They talk about voting machines breaking down. They talk about people being given a provisional ballot that didn't count. I mean, the fact that that is part of the national conversation around voting rights, I think that's a big step in the right direction towards making sure that these problems get fixed. You got to have people motivated. You got to have people even know that these are problems worth fixing. So that's something I think we're helping to contribute to. And I am really proud of that from the last year and a half.
I think I read an article maybe today in the New York Times about this, what's going on in Texas. They made a law that you can't have impermanent polling places. So a lot of this had to do with suppression of the student vote. There was a big uptick in student vote in 2018, quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so the reaction in some quarters seems to be, let's find a way to make it harder for students to vote, which seems awful. And Texas was one example of that where, okay, certain campuses had mobile or temporary voting. And so they passed a law saying every voting place has to be there for all of the days of the vote, whether if there's a period or the whole day, which is just transparent, right, that they don't want that turnout.
The classic, right? I mean, we saw something like this unfolding in Florida over the last year or two. So in summer of 2018, a federal court says the state can no longer ban public colleges from having an early vote site on campus, which is great, right? Terrific. And we and other advocates fought really hard to get sites added so the students could cast a ballot. Terrific news. What does the legislature do? Next thing you see is movement around trying to make it harder to have campus sites based on parking issues, right?
Right. That was part of this article.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So to your point earlier, steps forward, steps back, right? That's why we have our campaign. It is to address exactly those kinds of issues.
Would that kind of Texas law have found its way through preclearance? Was Texas a covered state?
Yes. And, you know, so it might have, right? I think that it would have had to go through the process, right? It would have had to get...
It seems like hard to imagine how that wouldn't be problematic, right? Although it might not be I don't know. Students are not a protected class.
But, yeah, so yeah. That's right. But the state would have been required, or the, you know, whatever jurisdiction was passing this rule, in this case, sounds like the state, would have been required to send it through preclearance, either through DOJ or federal court, and demonstrate that there was no impact, negative impact, on voters of color. That would have been a required step. And without that, you don't have to do that analysis.
Weren't you at DOJ at one point in your career?
I was.
Were you in a part of that institution that had anything to do with this?
I was not.
Okay. I'm curious about, like, the sources of your motivation to do this. You've made this a central part of your life.
Yeah, God, I guess
so. That seems a little, you know, that's, there are many things that one can do with one's life.
Yeah.
And this is what you've chosen. So there must be a certain amount of passion in that. Where did you start? What are the seeds of this interest for HANA?
Yeah. So, well, I grew up here in Washington, D.C., and my parents are longtime federal government folks. And I think they did instill in us a sense of public service and responsibility to the community and the world around us. I think for me, though, the focus on voting is because it is the underpinning of all of our other rights. I mean, if you cannot cast a ballot in an election, how else can you express yourself? It is the starting place of all these other rights, which is why I think that the denial of the right to vote is so insidious, so deeply troubling, that there are whole communities of people, whether it's people with a criminal conviction or it's people who are not able to get a voter ID, who are just blocked from that. I'm hard-pressed to think of anything worse, frankly.
Well, there's lots of things that are the underpinning, like education or, you know, the access to information that is accurate rather than misleading, so that you can be an informed citizen and cast a good ballot. But you've picked voting. What was the first time that you pursued that?
It's funny, I'm sort of thinking back on my own history. What is it that made it the thing for me?
Yeah.
You know, I think it was that I saw in real time the impact that voter disenfranchisement can have. I worked on a nonpartisan election protection hotline right out of college, and in the 2004 election.
Who goes to an election protection hotline?
Lots of people.
Yeah.
It's a great thing to do. Everyone should sign up. Everyone listening, sign up.
What did you do on an election protection hotline?
Oh, man, it's great. You will really feel like you've done something worthwhile with your day if you do it. I recommend it. So you, on the hotline, you sit and take calls from people who are having a problem casting a ballot. And so sometimes they're calling to say they just want to know where their polling place is, or, you know, they want some information about where and how to vote. But often they're calling because there's an issue that they got told that they didn't have the right kind of documentation, or the line was too long, or they went to what they thought was their polling location, but it's moved and they need help, and you help them.
And did it make you mad?
Oh, like, my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember still, I mean, this was a long time ago, but I still remember talking to this woman in Tennessee, and she had left her polling place. I think she was told she needed documentation to vote, something like that. I don't remember the precise situation. I don't remember the exact circumstances that led her to not being able to cast a ballot, but she actually was able to. She should have been given a ballot.
Yeah.
I've determined that based on the law that someone had, you know, prepared and spent the time to put together. And so I was in a position where I could help her. And I said, you should get back to the polls. And I told her when the polls closed, and I encouraged her to get back.
No one should have to go twice to the
polls. No one should have to go to the polls twice.
I mean, that's a pain in the ass.
That's, I mean, and people can't, right? They got to go to work. They have childcare, or elder care responsibilities.
It's hard. I mean, it's just people are living their lives. And they take one vote. What's the matter that much? Was this in your trajectory because, like, you were on the path to going to law school, which I know you did, and you thought this would be a good thing? Or did this spur you to go to law school? How did that fit together?
Neither, actually. I went to law school with the intention of doing something quite different.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to work in federal Indian law. You know, one thing I really appreciate about our work now is that we do work with advocates in tribal communities. And so there is some connection there, but I went down a somewhat different road.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it was that, you know, 2008 was when I was in school. I was finishing law school. That election was a huge election, regardless of sort of where you came down, yeah. right, on outcome and who you wanted to win, right? That was a time to be alive. Let me say that.
And you went and worked in it a little bit, right?
I did. Yeah. I saw the power of elections and of voting and of what it means to communities. And in that experience in 2008, I traveled all around the country and, you know, met a lot of voters. And to hear the way that people talked about voting and what it meant to them and to their families.
Some people, it's really emotional.
It right? is.
Because of the fights that it took to get.
Yeah.
What was your role in that campaign in 2008?
In 2008, I started by doing voter protection as a volunteer in the primaries.
And you were also involved in 2016?
I was, yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. And what was that role? How did it go?
I was working on behalf of long disenfranchised communities, that the focus of my work was on making sure that people could vote who had long been disenfranchised. And, you know, voters of color, students, voters with disabilities, that was the focus of my work. And that is really good work to do. It's really good work to do.
Yeah, I'm sure you can feel good at the end of the day that you're on the right side of things, right?
That's right. That's I had no important. Trouble sleeping. At night. Well, actually, I probably had a lot of trouble sleeping. Campaigns are intense.
But from what I've read, like in states like Wisconsin, laws that were designed to suppress the vote were successful. And that whereas vote turnout went up elsewhere in the country, it went down in that state for that reason. That they have voter ID laws there, right? That must have been awfully frustrating to watch that kind of, as you say, in real time.
I mean, the thing about turnout is that, you know, and this is true in 2018, is that turnout was record in 2018. But what that masks is that turnout is high for white voters, but voters of color, Latino voters, African-American voters, turnout rates still lag well behind.
Do they?
Yes. I don't want to get these numbers totally wrong for you, but I think it was somewhere between maybe 6 and 15 percentage points and for communities of color and white voters. I mean, that's
a
significant gap.
Considerably within different communities of color.
That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly.
So some communities of color vote at pretty similar rates and some vote much lower.
Yeah, but in 2018, what we saw, that number, that 50% turnout, that's talking about average turnout. And what it doesn't take into account is that African-American voters cast ballots at lower rates and Latino voters cast ballots at lower rates.
In that election.
And to use your Wisconsin example, the law there, the voter ID law has been, you know, is litigated, it's been talked about a lot. And, you know, this study from University of Wisconsin found that 11% of voters were deterred from voting by the voter ID law. That doesn't mean that they were stopped. That means that those are people who may have had the right ID and just didn't know it. And that's what the effect of these laws, too.
Or they didn't want to be questioned about their citizenship or their, you know, because someone in their family didn't have it. Or, like, things are complicated, right? If you put up even a little barrier, some people won't get over the barrier.
That's right. Yeah. And that deterrent effect is it spreads, right? I think that's the point of this study, that there were thousands, if not tens of thousands.
It means your vote is unwelcome in a certain way, right?
I think that's the message that people can hear. That's exactly right. And I think one of the things that's so important about the work that we do in the advocacy world is that, you know, you got to make sure that you clear these hurdles, but you also got to make sure that you're communicating with voters, that voters are hearing that message, that your vote will count, that we will help you, we will work with you, and that right is preserved and protected, that people care, right?
You've been very clear that all voting is local, is nonpartisan, mm-hmm. and that it's about fundamental rights. But that was a decision. Why is that the right way to do this?
Because this issue is one that we should all agree on, right? That everybody, no matter what their political affiliation, should come to agreement on. Taking it outside of that partisan space is really important. Having this work be rooted in legacy civil rights work is an important piece of this. It comes from that history, and it is still now an issue that we all should agree is fundamental, and that the right to vote is fundamental.
You recently, very recently, went and testified at the U.S. House, right?
Yeah.
At a committee.
Mm-hmm.
What were you talking about?
Yeah, I was there to talk about the state of voting rights and election administration today.
And what did you say?
Well, what I said in this.
See, I think you said something about it. The system being a little broken.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think I said a little. I think I just said it's broken. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Back to the pessimism we were talking about earlier. The evidence that we see, what we see everywhere in this country, is that there are significant hurdles to the right to vote. And we got to be talking about that.
So what do you want the Congress to do?
Well, I think one thing that happened is H.R. 4 passed out of committee, and that's the Voting Rights Advancement Act. It would restore key protections of the Voting Rights Act, including some of what we were talking about with preclearance. It also, though, would put into place certain requirements for states and cities all over the country that meet certain demographic thresholds. And, you know, if they engage in certain practices like closing polling places, removing language access, passing a voter ID law, stuff that's really connected to disenfranchisement, they'd be required to get that pre-approved as well.
Sounds like something that would have decent prospects of getting through a Democratic House. Sounds like something that would have poor prospects of getting through a Republican Senate. Is that right? Or
we'll
am
have
I wrong?
To see. We'll have to see. But look,
it ought to pass through both houses,
and
right?
And also, you know, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized in 2006 with bipartisan support, right? There was a time after 2000 when we thought, I mean, my God, this country couldn't get more fractured. But Congress then again, with bipartisan support, passed the Help America Vote Act, and George W. Bush signed that into law.
Yeah.
Right?
So you're hopeful that something might wend its way through the political process that would make a difference.
Always. Always.
If you were a betting woman.
Which I am not.
what odds would you give that of getting through before 2020?
I would say that if we look at recent history, like the Help America Vote Act's passage, and if we look at the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 06, that is the direction that we should be moving in. That should be our guiding light.
So you said you think it should happen, but you didn't say you think it will happen.
That is what I'm going to say about it. Let's look to history and be reminded of our values should be.
I will be delighted to see success in that.
Congress is one piece of this, right? The law is one piece of this. Federal law is one piece of this. But we also can do work right now to fix these problems. And that is our mission. And all voting is local.
But it sort of seems like you're out there with a machete trying to get through the trees. And it would be really nice if someone just made a big path from one place to another, which can be done by legislation.
Legislation is an important a vital sort of structural piece of this, right?
Yeah.
To have that structure in place that holds states to account, absolutely critical.
Yeah.
But I think that as important is the way you put that law into place, right? I mean,
yeah, it has to be administered.
It has to be administered in the right way. And that goes for state law as well, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, you have even a good law, even a positive reform, right?
Yeah.
Can get botched in the implementation. And you got to make sure that election officials have what they need to do their job, right? Their piece. And that there's accountability at that level too.
When you think about 50 states, is there a state that you think they're really doing it right?
We are seeing some great progress in states all across the country, right? I mean, states are increasingly adopting ways for people to vote before Election Day, which makes it easier for people with jobs and kids and older family members they got to take care of to cast a ballot on their own time, right? That's good. Vote by mail, universal vote by mail. That's a great step in the right direction. Voter registration modernization. We've seen states all across the country move towards systems that get people automatically into the voter registration lists. But at the same time, as we've been talking about, you know, some states are really, all states could stand to improve, right? I mean, Georgia got a ton of attention in 2018, but we see significant voter suppression problems in Pennsylvania, in New York.
So it's not entirely a red state, blue state problem.
I wouldn't describe it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, a lot of the stuff is really local. It's that implementation stuff that we've been talking about. That's a decision that a clerk in a town is making.
Is there a question that you wish I would ask that I haven't yet?
One thing that we haven't talked a ton about is our work in in 2018. And, you know, I'm happy to sort of talk about some of that and sort of where we're going.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that. What did you guys do in 2018?
Yeah. So across our states, we worked on issues related to polling place problems. Like in Florida, we were involved in this big push to get early vote sites on college campuses. Again, here, great decision by a federal court. Then you got to kind of get that across the finish line by making sure that election officials actually open up those early vote sites. What we really focused on was campuses that have a lot of students of color. So Florida International University, for example. And that was a big push for us. What we want to see going forward is Florida A&M University, which is the state's only public, historically Black university. We want to see them get an early vote site for 2020. They didn't have one, the only major public university in the state. So that's a big focus of ours and will be going forward.
How many people does that affect? I mean, having an early vote site at a campus.
So
how many people would use it?
Yeah, so early vote is wildly popular in Florida, and that's particularly true for African-American voters. That's why we push so hard to get those early vote sites, because it is an incredibly important part of making sure that communities across the state can get their vote counted.
I'm very happy that you're out there doing this kind of work. So appreciate your time talking about it today.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to say?
I'm good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was Hannah Fried at All Voting is Local. Hannah is at allvotingislocal.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.